I have a reading from Emily Pearl Kingsley. She writes, I am often asked to describe the experience of raising a child with a disability, to try to help people who have not shared that unique experience to understand it, to imagine how it would feel. So I say, it's like this. When you're going to have a baby, it's like planning a fabulous vacation trip to Italy. You buy a bunch of guidebooks and make your wonderful plans. The Colosseum, the Michelangelo David, the gondolas in Venice. You may learn some handy phrases in Italian. It's all very exciting. After months of eager anticipation, the day finally arrives. You pack your bags and off you go. Several hours later, the plane lands. The flight attendant comes on and says, "Welcome to Holland." Holland, you say? What do you mean, Holland? I signed up for Italy. I'm supposed to be in Italy. All my life, I've dreamed of going to Italy. But there's been a change in the flight plan. They've landed in Holland, and there you must stay. The important thing is that they haven't taken you to some horrible, disgusting, filthy place full of famine and disease. I mean, it's just a different place. So you must go out and buy new guidebooks. And you must learn a whole new language. And you will meet a whole new group of people you would have never met. It's just a different place. It's slower paced than Italy, less flashy than Italy. But after you've been there for a while and you catch your breath, you look around and you begin to notice that Holland has windmills. And Holland has tulips. Holland even has Rembrandts. But everyone you know is busy coming and going from Italy. And they're all bragging about what a wonderful time they've had there. And for the rest of your life, you will say, yes, that is where I was supposed to go. That's what I'd planned. And the pain of that will never really go away. And the loss of that dream is a significant loss. But if you spend your life mourning the fact that you didn't go to Italy, then you may never really be free to enjoy the very special, incredibly amazing things about Holland.
So we're exploring these three ways that you might respond to a curveball. That saying yes, embracing and moving with it. That no, that refusal that Melissa beautifully demonstrated. Or that pass, that way of saying this is not mine. So I want to talk about the first two. So in college, one of my jobs was to teach conflict resolution skills to elementary and junior high school students. Constituents that are renowned for their extensive conflict resolution capacity. And one of the activities that we did was we placed a line of tape down the classroom from one side to the other, and we paired up students so they were facing a partner across the line. And we told them that in this activity, the point of the game was that they needed to convince their partner to come to the other side of the line. That's what we told them. So as you can imagine, as the game began, pairs faced off and started to threaten each other, started to plead with each other, started to bargain with snacks from their lunches, other activities, other niceties that might convince their partner to move to the other side. But usually after 5 minutes, the only movement...
Incorporate a language other than English.
I'm gonna pass. So... does someone here speak another language that wants to offer some, like, one, a phrase maybe after I'm done that you think is relevant? Could be any language. All right, we got one here. So at the end, I'll just turn to you and bring you a mic and we can figure this out, all right? Perfect. All right, so after the activity is done, the only movement usually occurs from the pairs that don't really care about the activity. Like, if you're kind of checked out of this class, there was movement. But other than that, people pretty much remained where they were. And so it was at this point that me and my co-trainer would say, okay, well, we're going to show you a way that might allow you to deal with this. So we got them all, the students, to sit down, and we stood across the wall, or I mean the line from each other. And instead of saying, like, why don't you come to my side of the wall, or, well, sorry, line, and pleading on that level, we said, well, why don't you come to my side, and I'll come to your side, and then maybe we'll both win. And so we did. It was at that point that the class usually erupted in horror. I mean, we had broken the rules. The rules clearly stated that the point of the game was to convince your partner to come to the other side of the line. Oh. Didn't say that you lost when you did. It merely said that you'd win if that would happen. And usually there was this annoying light bulb that would go off in some of their minds. And this activity was supposed to demonstrate a principle in negotiation, actually. That sometimes when we're negotiating with another person, another political party, we get stuck in our positions, these manifestations of what we want. We get entrenched by the specific thing that we're wanting. You come to my side, I'll come to your side, what have you. But we don't go down deeper to the interests, the values, something that lies beyond that. And in fact, those interests, those things beyond the manifestation or the tangible, well, it's in fact there that usually we're able to find some sort of common ground, or at least some compromise that allows us to live. It's that principle that I think allows us to respond to life's curveballs with a yes. Much of the time, the curveball is not taking us into a place or a situation that we want to go. And yet what we may find is that below our top of the iceberg of what we imagined or what we wanted, there is another way of fulfilling that desire in this new world, a perfectly wonderful vacation in Holland, if only we are able to actually receive it. That being said, though, some of the times when we receive these curveballs and we decide to say yes, we can lose that underlying interest or value or something that's important to us. Sometimes when life throws us such a big shift in saying yes or moving with it, we can actually step away from a core part of who we are. And that is, of course, the danger of saying yes. All right. So the other day, I was at Blockbuster Video checking out a VHS. Yesterday. Oh, right. Would it surprise you if I told you that in the year 2000, the founder of Netflix approached Blockbuster and said, I will offer you my entire company for $50 million? Well, it happened. The CEO of Blockbuster at the time said, we're not interested in Netflix, as it's a very small niche business that probably doesn't have a future. Just for record, how many of you have an active Blockbuster membership right now? Now, the interesting thing about Blockbuster and Netflix is that they were both dealing with the same realities in life. the disruption of the internet, the changes in technology. And yet both of them were able to respond or not to these changes, to say no or yes in different ways. For if you'll remember, Netflix actually started out sending people DVDs in the mail. Now, they did this before the majority of people in the country had a DVD player. I mean, what a great business model. You're sending people a thing that the majority of people couldn't use. They definitely were resisting something. And then once the internet actually allowed you to like download videos, they pivoted away from the mail towards streaming. And at one point, the networks, the movie production companies, started to realize that this Netflix thing was taking off. And so they started to raise the rates in which they would sell their content to Netflix to try to, you know, make some money on this shift. So what did Netflix do? They started to make their own shows. Brought it in-house. At each of these moments, they resisted kind of that outside first, that force, that curveball, the realities of the market, the shifts that were going on. They resisted the conventional wisdom. They stuck their course to say that there was a disruption that was needed. Whereas Blockbuster, well, they resisted the shifts to their own peril, imagining that the internet or sending people DVDs in the mail was a niche market. Saying no or resisting life's curveballs is a beautiful thing when you want to change the status quo, to not accept a shift in the facts on the ground, that you actually want to work against it. And yet, the downside of that is sometimes the world moves on, and we don't. And that can be a very difficult place to be. Amen. Oh, yes, sorry. Do you have an offering in a language that might help?
Samasta loka sukino bhavantu.
Would you offer a...
May all beings in all the worlds be happy in Sanskrit.
Thank you.
And we're about to sing Wo Ya Ya, number 1020 in your hymnal. Number 1020 in the teal hymnal. As you feel ready in your body, it's rising up to sing. We are going. Here we go. Let's decide.
Give the balance on one foot version.
Okay. Well, this is a congregational moment, so we need to decide if we are going to do the balance on one foot version of this song, or if we are going to say no to that, or if you're going to find somebody else to do it.
I mean, it could be interesting if we're singing and we're balancing on one foot, and once... you can't balance any longer, you sit down, and then we continue singing until, you know. I mean, it's just an option.
Okay, is that a yes to Sean's suggestion? All right, let's do it. Here we go. Starting over from the top.
We are going, heaven knows where we are going, but we go within.
Who's balancing?
And we'll get there. Heaven knows how we will get there, but we know we will. It will be hard, we know, and the road will be muddy and rough, but we'll get there. Heaven knows how we will get there, but we know we will. And we'll get there. Heaven heaven knows how we will get there.
But we know we will. Wa-ya-ya, wa-ya-ya.
Happen if you would have had to sit down first and then we just keep going. So as some of you know, my partner and I, we adopted our children through a foster adoptive process. It's basically like saying, just like opening yourself up to a like curveballs just automatically. Just so the process is basically you get approved and then you wait for a call to come to dramatically shift everything that you know. So we, early in our process, we had been approved, and it was maybe like a month or so, and we got a call. It was like a regular old day, like 9 or 10 in the morning, and the call came through, and they said, "Well, we have a baby boy. The baby is at the hospital, and he's ready to be picked up. Would you be interested?" They gave us some information about him. He was medically fragile, which meant that he was probably going to need to be in the hospital for some extended period of time. You know, who knows? They gave us a little more information about his background, and they said, "Okay, you can have some time to think about it if you would like to accept this placement or not." And actually, they gave us the weekend, which maybe sounds short, but in the foster adoptive process is actually quite long. So we were, as you can imagine, it was our first child. We'd never had a kid before. We were very eager to become parents, as you often are in that, or the beginning stages, just hoping for this call. But we thought we should go ahead and take the weekend and consider. So we actually took a trip to the sand dunes in southern Colorado and decided to spend some time just contemplating, walking the sands, considering how this little boy
incorporate silence.
I'm in on that. I haven't used one yet, have I? I don't think so. How this little boy spoke to us in our lives and if he would be a fit for us. His name was Marcus. So we were thinking about Marcus and whether he was meant to be our son. As we were contemplating, we spent many moments in silence, walking the sand dunes and looking out over the Sangre de Cristo. It was there, over the Sangre de Cristo mountain range, that we decided to pass, to let someone else become this child's mother. It was not an easy decision, but it became clear.